It's time for the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel Podcast.
We've got lots and lots of things to talk about and to do today.
Covering the territories from the 1940s to the 1990s.
It's the best thing going today.
Interviewing wrestlers, referees, authors, and other media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great.
The cream, yeah. The cream of the crop.
And now, here's your host, Tony Richards.
Hey there, everybody. This is Tony Richards, and I want to welcome you to our Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. On our show, we're tracking and documenting the history of pro wrestling from its beginnings through 1990, with special emphasis on the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s pre-video era. We're profiling personalities by having the authors who've studied their lives and written their stories. We're studying and revisiting territories and the booking offices that control them, historic towns where the history of pro wrestling is so deep, and the legendary buildings where the fans came to see their favorite stars and storylines play out virtually every single week. We're covering all four of these dimensions of the sport of pro wrestling, and I'm so appreciative you've decided to allocate some of your time to go on this journey with us through this show. If you like what we're doing, you might want to think about visiting my Substack channel by searching for Tony Richards 4, and there you can subscribe to my daily wrestling history newsletter, where you'll find birthdays of wrestlers past and present, an RIP salute daily to those in the business who we want to honor that have passed on, an event on that day in pro wrestling history, and much, much more. You'll also have an archive of this podcast and special updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book. All of that is provided for free. But I do have a special vault of writings for paid subscribers. And by subscribing to that, that helps support me and my research and the work to do all of this for you. You'll find it all on my Substack channel, substack.com. Search for Tony Richards 4 and the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. You can also follow me on X at Tony Richards 4 or join our Facebook group, Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Okay, with all that out there, let's go to today's show and today's guest. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel video and podcast. This is your host, Tony Richards. When we dive into pro wrestling's territories, buildings, and towns, and we talk about the great territories, we talk about the historic buildings and the legendary towns of pro wrestling in the 40s, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And here today, I'm excited because we're going to talk about a territory that a lot of people don't talk about. As a matter of fact, a lot of people don't even know that it was around. And some of us that were alive back in 1975 knew about it, but we weren't exposed to it. So I'm excited today to welcome the guy that I know who knows more about this than anybody else out there, and that's Michael Norris, who's a historian who has studied this territory for years. And he is on our show today. Michael, welcome aboard.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, this territory, I actually grew up in Mobile. Well, I didn't grow up there. I was an Army brat until I was 12 years old. Then when my father did his last tour of Vietnam, my mother insisted that we move to Mobile, Alabama, which is where her parents were. And my grandfather was a wrestling nut going back to the late 40s, early 50s.
Oh, and, my. Who was a big star your grandfather liked?
Lee Fields, and hated Mario Galento.
Oh,
It was such a thrill for me in 1981 when I was during my brief career as a professional wrestler before I decided that as a wrestler I made a better historian. I was what I thought was going to be a shot for Ron Fuller, who figures into this story later on down the road. I was supposed to go do Dothan TV and do the house show at the Farm Center that night. Well, I get down there, do my TV match and everything, and Bob Armstrong, who was Fuller's booker, came up to me and said, "We're going to need you here for a couple of weeks full time." I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He said, "But we need you to show up, and you're booked in Dothan tonight as Mr. Junior America. We need you under a hood." I'm like, I don't have a mask. I didn't know anything about this. You know, nobody told me about it. And Mario Galento, who was on the card that night, they were bringing him in as a special guest to team with Bob Armstrong. He said, "Boy, come here." He took me back. out of the back of the TV studio, popped open the trunk of his Cadillac. He had 15, 16 full outfits in there with masks and all this stuff. He said, reach in there and get you one.
Oh, my God.
Well, I recognized one of the old Blue Demon masks or outfits that Frank Martinez and Tamayo Soto wore during their run as the Blue Demons in Florida and in the Mobile territory. But they were also the Super Assassins in Atlanta. So I recognized that right away, and I snatched on that. Well, I had it for 2 weeks and ran my – it was the only time I ever worked full-time in the business was those 2 weeks working for Fuller's Mr. Junior America.
You were Mr. And Junior America in a Blue Demon outfit.
Yeah, in a Blue Demon outfit. So
that's awesome.
So I told Mario, I said, you know what? I said, it's a thrill for me to meet you, number one, because, I mean, Mario Galante was a legend in that part of the world. And I said, my grandfather hated your guts.
That probably made him feel good.
Yeah, I mean, and Mario was probably 70 years old. This was in 81, so he was probably every bit of 70 years old because he was nearly 40 when he broke in the early 50s.
Well, I was just having a conversation with somebody yesterday about back in these days we're talking about, these guys took it as a badge of honor and as a source of pride if people absolutely hated them. I mean, it was a key to their making money. It was a key to drawing money, and that probably made him feel wonderful that you told him that. That was a badge of honor, probably.
First time I worked a show with Eddie Sullivan, Benny Hizar, who was known mainly as Eddie Sullivan. I told him, I said, when I was a kid, I hated you and Rip Tyler more than anything in this world. He said, well, that means we did our jobs right.
Yeah, that's right. So tell us a little bit about, so your grandfather was a wrestling fan, and that led you to be a wrestling fan, right? And so,
yeah, it kind of led me back to it. Before my father did his second tour of Vietnam, his last tour, he was stationed at Fort Benning, and we lived in Columbus, Georgia. And I don't know, never did find out the guy's name. You know, I've talked to, you know, Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons and people who, you know, were associated with the Fred Ward promotion in Columbus, and nobody could help me figure out who it was. We lived across the street from a guy who worked for the Fred Ward promotion. I don't know what he did there, but he used to take my brother and I to the live TV tapings on Saturdays down on Front Street. And I went to third grade. You know who Bad Boy Hines is, right? Jimmy Hines.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
I went to school. I was a classmate of his son, Gary, in the third grade. I used to go to Jimmy Hines' house.
Wow. Yeah, I'm working on a book about Dory Funk Sr. in Amarillo, and Bad Boy Hines was a big-time heel there in the 50s.
Yeah, yeah. He was originally from Houston. That's where he was born and raised. I take it back. He was born in Montgomery, but he grew up in Houston, and he broke in Houston. Billy Hines, of course, they were no relation. Billy Hines' real name was Owen Yao. He was from West Virginia, I want to say, but he was a former pro boxer. He boxed under the name Billy Cox, and he wrestled under the name of Billy Cox when he first started wrestling. In fact, he and Jimmy, first place they ever worked together was the Mobile territory.
Oh, goodness.
They teamed up for the first time in 63, and Billy had been in as Billy Cox, worked a couple of weeks as Billy Cox, was gone a while, and then 6 months later, Billy Boy Hines shows up. Same guy.
I think a lot of people confuse. A lot of people, when they talk about the National Wrestling Alliance, they talk like the territory is the member, but the territory is really based in the booking office. The booking office is really the NWA member, and that booking office was in Mobile. When did that kind of come about? When did Mobile have a booking office? Do you know?
Yeah, it started in 1954, but prior to the formation of what became the Gulf Coast Territory, Mobile was just basically a place for the boys to work to make gas money between Birmingham and New Orleans. The territory was set up, or it really wasn't a territory. How that area was set up was you had Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. Joe Gunther pretty much He was based in Birmingham. He pretty much ran all of that. He had the promotional, owned the promotional rights to promote in the state of Alabama.
And that was now issued by the, it was, did Alabama have a commission then, or?
Yes, it was issued by the Alabama State Commission.
Okay.
Boxing and Wrestling Commission. But he had his own stable of guys that worked for him, Tarzan White, Nick Adams, guys like that. And he also had part ownership of the office in New Orleans, who was, up until 1950, was run by a guy by the name of Jim Murtaugh. Well, Jim Murtaugh's health was bad. So starting in 1950, his wife, Ernestine Murtaugh, was the actual promoter. And Gunther had a part of that office, owned a part of that office. But I'll get back to Louisiana. But anyway, Alabama
one question, was she active or did she just hold the license?
Yes, no, she was very active.
Oh, good. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So all this we hear about, all of us here, we hear about female promoters. This has been going on for a while.
Everybody makes a big deal about Eileen Eaton being the very first one. Eileen Eaton didn't actually become a promoter until 1966.
Right, passed away, right?
Yeah, right, when Cal Eaton passed away. Ernestine Murtaugh started promoting in 1950.
Goodness
gracious. When her husband got sick. Also in Louisiana, Claudine Killshaw was also the promoter in Baton Rouge.
So this this last name sounds familiar to me, Killshaw.
Yeah, her husband, Jimmy Killshaw, was the promoter in Louisiana, was one of the major promoters in several cities in Louisiana, but mainly in Baton Rouge. He died in 1949, and she continued. So you had two female promoters in the 50s there. In the 60s, Midge Monroe was the promoter in Baton Rouge. In Alexandria. Alexandria. Midge Monroe. She was Sputnik Monroe's wife.
Oh, okay.
So she was the promoter in Alexandria. Of course, you know, Sputnik was doing all the booking and everything.
Sure.
But anyway, you know, you had various people in Alabama that ran smaller towns, but they got all their talent from Joe Gunther. The same thing in Mississippi. The promoter that had the majority of the big towns, like in Greenville, Greenwood, Hattiesburg, Jackson, was Billy Romanoff, who was a former wrestler, just like Joe Gunther was. Now, the Gulf Coast area, really along the actual Gulf Coast, really didn't have, you know, wasn't running a whole lot. There was a guy named by the name of Tony Everts, who for a couple of years ran Gulfport and Pascagoula, which to me seems ridiculous because they're only 15, 20 miles apart. But back in those days, prior to, you know, interstates. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he ran those for a couple of years. And then for whatever reason, Vicksburg was the only town they ran Jack and George Curtis. That was their town. You're familiar with them, I'm assuming.
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah, yeah.
They were stepbrothers.
They were in and out with Leroy and Bill Watts, right?
Jack Jr. was. Jack Curtis was the older. He was a big star in the 40s through the 50s. And George Culkin was his stepbrother, or half-brother, I should say.
And so... And, How does that get to Gil? What's Gil?
Gil is George's son.
Okay, all right.
And Jack, Jack's nephew. And Jack had two sons, Jack Jr. and Randy, who both wrestled. And Jack Jr. was in with Watts during the Mid-South days. So, but that's how Mississippi was split up. And in Biloxi, also in between. This is even stranger. In between Gulfport and Pascagoula, Biloxi sits dead in between them. I mean, it's not 30 miles between one end of Gulfport to the other end of Biloxi with Pascagoula with Biloxi in the middle. Biloxi would promote various times. You know, neither one of these, neither Pascagoula, Gulfport, or Biloxi were weekly towns. They'd run once a month, a couple of times a month, you know, something like that. But the promoter there was a guy by the name of Junior Dalgo, and then he did it for a year, and then a guy named Pete Olmos did it for a year.
What kind of crowds did these towns have, Michael?
300-400. I mean, most of these towns, they would have these local promoters. Generally, they were the ones who owned the building. You know, there was a particular town in Alabama, up north Alabama somewhere, I'm going to say Anniston or somewhere like that. The place where they ran the shows was actually the top floor of a grocery store, and the promoter was the guy that owned the grocery store.
And did I love this. And so let me ask you this. So back in a lot of these days, you had to have a organizational sponsor. Did they have to have that in these states too? Did you have to have the VFW or somebody like that be in with you?
They generally did, but it wasn't a necessity. It was generally, a better way of selling tickets to have a sponsor,
a promotional vehicle more than a regulation. So, okay.
Now, Louisiana was totally different from Mississippi and Alabama, whereas they had, somebody who controlled the majority of the state, one guy that controlled the majority of the state, and Billy Romanoff and Joe Gunther. Louisiana was actually set up with people, with an individual promoter that ran on a weekly basis. New Orleans, as I mentioned, was Ernestine Murtaugh. Alexandria was Jimmy Thompson, again, somebody who owned his own arena. The Jimmy Thompson Arena was used all the way up and through 69, I think, from 1950 to 1969.
And when they would book these shows to come into these basically independent arenas and independent promoters, did they just let the crew they brought in, did they just let them figure out what the show was going to be, or how'd they do? Because they didn't do the booking, right? Did they?
No, Joe Gunther did the booking for his crew. He used Tarzan White and Nick Adams to kind of be the on-hand, guys running the show. Now, they obviously had, things they had in mind that they wanted to do. But back in these days, you didn't have, like they had programs where, we're going to set this guy up to work this guy for 6 weeks, and they're going to swap titles and all that. They didn't do all that. They put together three matches, and boom, 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 it's over with,
Yeah, right, yeah.
They usually had, a prelim match made up of one of the guys that's in the second or third, match, tag match, and the other, that was a single fall match, and then they'd have two, best two out of three, and these guys would work 45 minutes. You'd get a three-hour show out of three matches.
Yeah. I know in Texas a lot of times they'd do what they call the Wrestle Royal, where they'd have a Battle Royal, and the two guys that won the Battle Royal would have a match, and that'd be a card.
They used to do that in the Mobile territory. They'd start with the Battle Royal. They'd start with five guys in the match, in the match. First guy eliminated, he was done for the night. The next two out, they would come back in the semifinal to work a two out of three fall match, and the last two guys would work the main event, a two out of three fall match.
Yeah, I see. All right.
So,
that's a smart way to make it different, I think.
Oh, yeah. And it's also a cheap way to get,
Yeah, you got six guys in a car. There you go.
Or there were times that they would have start the Battle Royal with no referee, and the first guy thrown out, he would referee the next two matches. So you wouldn't even have to pay a referee.
Oh, wow. Well, that's smart.
Then back to Louisiana, you had Monroe was the other full-time town, and that was Gus Callio, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that name. He was very, very famous in the 20s and 30s. He was like the perennial world light heavyweight or lightweight champion.
Okay.
And
I haven't heard that name before.
He built his own building there that was a skating rink every other day except the night he had wrestling matches there. And it was called Callio Sports Arena. So, and then you had Northwest Florida in this as well. And Pensacola was the only town that really ran weekly. And that was only for a couple of years. And the promoter there was a guy by the name of Vic Kalfas, who was a restaurant owner. He owned a restaurant there in Pensacola. And in 52, at the end of 52, he decided he wanted to go back to just being in the restaurant business. And a couple of other guys came in and tried to run Pensacola, but that really, it really didn't work. Panama City, Joe Gunther ran there and Fort Walton a handful of times, but that was, you know, Northwest Florida really wasn't much either.
Joe Gunther was a power player.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, he was, you know, during the, he retired from the business fairly young. I don't know if it was due to an injury or not, but he was a major star in that part of the world until he started promoting in the '40s. So, and he was based in Birmingham. And at one point, it didn't last long, maybe 6 weeks, Don McIntyre was coming over from Atlanta. You know, he owned the Atlanta office at that time.
Right.
He was coming over and running opposition to Gunther in Birmingham.
Now we're kind of getting into the area I'm a little more familiar with. Like I know who Don McIntyre is, so this is good. I'm feeling familiar now, and I'm also feel like I'm learning something though. So I'm excited. I like this, Michael. This is wonderful. Keep going.
But of course, they use Paul Jones's name mm-hmm. as the promoter, but McIntyre owned the territory. Paul Jones, but, I don't know. You're familiar with Paul Jones and his history, right?
He's a former wrestler. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, he never really was that successful as a promoter and really didn't promote Atlanta that long, even though he was the front man for 40 years as the Atlanta promoter.
Yeah,
He owned a piece of the office, but he was so politically connected in the city of Atlanta, you know, that they always used him as the front man. And, of course, back in those days, you had McIntyre on the territory in the 50s, and then in the 60s, it was Gunkel and Fuller. And regardless of whether they were really legit or not, the state athletic commissions did not let a promoter also be an active competitor.
Right.
That's why the majority of these promoters all had front men.
Yeah, that was the situation in Texas because Doc Sarpolis owned the territory and he sold points in it to Dory Funk Sr., but they only wrestled him or sent him a wrestler's license. They wouldn't grant him that. And he, Dory Funk Sr., didn't really want anybody to know he was involved in the ownership. So it was pretty much Doc Sarpolis out front all the time.
Well, I mean, you know, Farhat used his father-in-law in Detroit. I don't know who Snyder and Bruiser used as the front man for their promotion. I think maybe it was, I know the promoter's license was actually under Bruiser's mother's name, I think.
Yeah, I believe that's right. I believe that's right.
Yeah, but anyway, that's how the territory was set up. And these three different states, or four different states, if you count Northwest Florida, they all drew their talent from two places, Gunther in Birmingham or Roy Welch and Nick Gulas out of Nashville. So, you know, and the only titles that were recognized, there were two titles that were generally defended. The main one was the World Light Heavyweight title. You had guys like Rex Mobley and Jack Curtis, Mike Chicoma, guys like that, Buff Saroas. You know, they swapped this title back and forth. Balk Estes at one time held it. And then they also had a non-NWA-sanctioned World Junior Heavyweight title that was usually held by Tarzan White. So these were the main titles. They weren't, you know, like, there wasn't a Louisiana title or a Mississippi title or this. That didn't come along until years later. But in 1953, Roy Welch, minus Gulas, this was just Roy Welch, he bought out all of Alabama from Joe Gunther.
All of
Joe
Alabama.
Gunther, he bought the promotional rights
for the state.
And Gunther, actually, after years of living in Birmingham, moved to New Orleans and took over as the booker for Ernestine Murtaugh. So he got out of Alabama totally and moved to Louisiana. Welch did the same thing in Mississippi. He bought all of Billy Romanoff's towns. The only one he didn't get was Vicksburg, again, because of the Curtises.
So now Roy owns all of Alabama and all of Mississippi? Okay.
Yep. Now, I don't know. Now, he may have already had, they may have already been running Tupelo because it's so close to Memphis. I don't know that either.
Yeah.
But yeah, so he ran through 1953 into 1954. He continued to book, you know, the guys out of the Nashville office into there and started moving away from Louisiana. So Louisiana is kind of drifting out of the block. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And they're becoming separate on their own. And then in 54 is when Roy brought his son in to Mobile, Edward, which is, of course, with Buddy Fuller. Uh-huh. And Buddy was, he started taking on more and more and more of the running of the thing, and Roy backed out of it. By the end of 54, Roy was even out of Mississippi. He quit promoting Mississippi totally and moved back to Nashville. And Mississippi really never did do a whole lot. They would do sporadically, but it was not the weekly shows again, except for Vicksburg.
So when because, you say when you said that he was totally out of Mississippi and moved back to Nashville, where was he living?
Well, I mean, he moved his focus back to Nashville.
I see. Okay. Well,
yeah, he never left Dyersburg. He was always in Dyersburg.
Yeah, that was my question. Is did he do these things that he was doing on his own? Did he do that from Dyersburg or did he do it from Nashville? So you just
no, he did it from Dyersburg. I mean, because he was providing talent for these shows, you know, anyway. So I'm sure he had somebody, whether it's Red Roberts or whoever he was sending down there, kind of running the programs and the, you know, for the local promoters. But in 54, Buddy Fuller got heavily involved. By that time, Lee Fields had already shown up. Mario Galento was already in place. Guys like Billy Wicks, you know, a lot of the Memphis guys were coming down into the Mobile territory and they were starting to build their own group of towns. Jack Welch, the second oldest of the Welch brothers, Roy's next oldest brother, he was running Dothan for them. He used a guy by the name of Ben Hassan as his front man because Jack was still an active wrestler too. So that's when you say,
those were my grandfather's favorite wrestlers were Roy and Herb Welch. They were the big tag team in Western Kentucky. My grandfather just loved them.
Exactly. In fact, they're credited, it's false, but they're credited for being the inventors of tag team wrestling.
Oh, if you talk to anybody older than 65 in Kentucky, they'll tell you that. Because sure. They didn't know anything else, you know. That was just the Welches would come and run the bad guys out of the state, you know. That was the thing.
Yeah, so starting in 54, you started to see the influx of the Welch influence. You saw Lester was there, Jack was there. Even Roy came down and wrestled once in Mobile. Buddy Fuller was there, Lee Fields was there, Don Fields was there, Bobby Fields was breaking in there. You had old-timers like Charlie Carr and all these guys that were, you know, what I call branch Welches, Baby Blimp, George Harris, mm-hmm. you know, that whole Dyersburg crowd.
Right, right. Guys that have been around for a long time and really kept them around working for him, sure.
And along with a name that will come up later on, Norman McGuire, Rocky McGuire, who was from Cleveland, Tennessee, was best friends with a guy by the name of Don Gaston from elementary school on for the rest of their lives, I guess. And if you're not familiar with the name Don Gaston, he was better known as Don Carson.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Who will also become a major figure in the Gulf Coast Territory as it developed. But so as Buddy started to take on more and more, the Mobile Territory started kind of beginning to develop into what became the Gulf Coast Territory. Louisiana was out. Mississippi was out. They would still run, you know, some of those guys would go work one of those states, but everything was focused on Mobile, Pensacola, Dothan, Panama City. Periodically, they would go to Montgomery, but not often. Every once in a while, they'd go to Tallahassee, but not often.
So if I missed it, I'm sorry, but did Roy sell that or did he just vacate
no.
it?
What, Mississippi?
Mississippi. Yeah, Mississippi.
I don't know. He just stopped promoting there. And after he left, now he did, I know one town he did maintain the promotional rights to, and that was Hattiesburg. But he didn't do any, they didn't promote there for a while. But other than Vicksburg, nothing in Mississippi really ran on a full-time basis after that. Because Romanoff was out, and you had, you know, a handful of other guys. Rex Mobley tried to run some, you know, using some of the old timers from the 40s and stuff like that. And he would do it for a while and then he wouldn't for a while. And then, you know, it never really did stay formed as a weekly thing. But in 1955, Buddy Fuller made his first big decision that would effectively help the Mobile territory grow into what it became. Prior to that, all the way starting back in the 40s, when Joe Gunther was still promoting down there, they used a building called the Shrine Auditorium. And the Shrine Auditorium, I've actually been in it. It still exists. It was owned at that time by the Mobile Shriners. It was a tin building, a bit, looked like a miniature airplane hangar. It maybe held 300 people, but the Shriners would not let in black fans. It was whites only. And Buddy Fuller tried every way he could to let them have them open up to black fans. They wouldn't do it. So he said, fine, I won't promote here anymore. I will not run shows here anymore. He made a deal with the Brooklyn Air Force Base for their armory, the Fort Whiting Armory, which if you're familiar with the Fort Hesterly Armory in Tampa.
Yes.
Nearly identical building.
Oh, wow.
It's still there. It's still there on Brooklyn Field, still in Mobile. And so he went from about 300 fans in, you know, the Shrine Auditorium to 2,000, I think, in Fort Whiting. Started letting in black fans. Summertime, he would run at Hartwell Field, which was an outdoor baseball stadium for the Mobile Bears, which was a minor league or a farm league team for the New York Yankees. So when they were not playing, he would run shows there. And a couple times, and I don't know if you've ever listened to Ron Fuller's podcast.
Oh, it's been a long time ago. Yeah, but sure, I have.
And again, this is no fault of Ron's, but he's told the story many times about his father and Mario Galento selling out Ladd Stadium in Mobile. Well, the match that he claims happened there never happened. They only ran Ladd Stadium twice. They drew 10,000 people both times, but it was only half the stadium. They only used half the stadium.
Yeah, sure.
But still, for a town in the 50s, you know, late 50s, Mobile's population was 45, 50,000 people maybe. 10,000 people is a hell of a crowd.
Yeah. Yeah,
but I mean, the main event on both of those included Lee Fields, not Buddy Fuller. But
so Buddy and Mario never had a match in Mobile?
They did, but it wasn't at Ladd Stadium. It wasn't the one to do the big crowd like that. Yes, Buddy really didn't wrestle all that often in Mobile,
mm-hmm.
because so you know even
two,
though
their two big matches were in Memphis and Atlanta, right? Buddy and Mario.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, well, I don't know that they ever wrestled at Memphis. I think with Billy Wicks and Mario. No, that was Billy Wicks and Sputnik was the big one. And
that's correct. Yes,
but
they did the big match at Rustwood Park. Sputnik and Billy Wicks were at Rustwood Park. That was their big match.
Right, which was a Welsh invention, that the Cadillac tournament. They did those. I think Ron was still doing those in the '80s.
Oh yeah.
But anyway, so Buddy, they kind of kept it hidden that he, because he was still an active wrestler, that he was the promoter. So they would use front men, usually Rocky McGuire. They'd use him as a promoter. Now, how Rocky fell in with the Welch family, I don't know. But like I said, he was part of that Dyersburg crowd, and he was a wrestling person. You know, he was actually in the business and everything. But then every once in a while, they would use somebody like Leroy Morris, who was a radio announcer in Pensacola. They would front him as the Mobile promoter. Buddy had a friend named, He was called Eddie Pericola, and he was listed as the promoter in Pensacola and Panama City. His real name was Frank Pericola, and he was the editor of the Panama City News newspaper.
Well, Buddy was Buddy was doing all this promoting in Alabama when, I mean, we didn't have a large television penetration yet in the mid-50s, right? I mean, he was selling a lot of tickets with no, I mean, it was all on-the-ground promotion to do.
Well, they had TV in Mobile. They did a live show on Saturday nights. In fact, one of the most famous things they did, Mario Galento and I can't remember who it was. They tore up the studio.
So they actually did it at the television studio?
Yeah, they did it at the studio on Government Street, Mobile.
Okay. Because a lot of guys in those days, they did them live from whatever arena they were at, right? But that's kind of cool. They had a studio show that early.
Yeah, and it was a live show. Yeah, they did, Channel 5 wrestling went on until, oh, God, until the end of the 60s. And it was live, you know, through that time. But so Buddy would use these different people. And Buddy also owned a large ranch in Loxley, Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm familiar with the Loxley Ranch.
And that, according to Skippy Wetchen, who was another guy who figures into this, Skippy Wetchen owned the Five Flags Motor Speedway in Pensacola. Well, Buddy was a big race car fan. He raced cars as well. In fact, he would have, out on that ranch, he would have rodeos. He would have dirt track, you know, dirt car races out there and all this stuff. So he became big friends with Skippy Wetchen. And he decided to go back into Mississippi in some towns that nobody else was running that were close enough to where, you know, the guys could get to out of Mobile. And 1958, he set Skippy Wetchen up as the promoter in Hattiesburg, Laurel, and Gulfport. But anyway, when the Welches first started moving in there, the only title they had that they recognized was the old Southern Junior Heavyweight title based in Nashville. And periodically, Fred Blassie would come over from Atlanta as the Southern Heavyweight Champion. They developed established the first Gulf Coast title in 1957. And that match, the final of, they had a 12-week-long tournament. And the final match came down to Lee Fields and Eduardo Perez. And that was the first night that they ran Ladd Stadium and drew 10,000 people. And it was a Cadillac tournament.
So the guy who was the champion in Nashville with the Southern Junior Heavyweight Championship, was that be the same guy, or did they use different
same
guys?
Yeah, same guy. Okay. Same guy. Yeah, it was either Red Roberts or Ray Perrette was one that came down from up there that had that title. And at one time, after Mario Galento, the first Gulf Coast champion was Eduardo Perez. They kind of pulled a swerve. Everybody was figuring it was going to be Lee Fields, but it wasn't. It was Eduardo Perez. And then he dropped the title to Mario Galento in a rare heel versus heel thing. And Mario then turned around and beat Red Roberts for the Southern Junior Heavyweight title, and he held both titles for about 3 weeks.
Oh, wow. Yeah, is that the famous picture on the Internet of him having two belts
yep.
on?
Yep. Okay. That is it. And that belt, that Gulf Coast belt that they had in, of course, it was redone several times, but the one that they presented in 1957, Bob Kelly still had it when he passed away.
Oh, my gosh, whatever happened to it?
I don't know. The building where we used to have the Gulf Coast reunion, he had built a little museum and it was in there. But, you know, after he passed away, I'm not sure what his children did with all that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that's pretty much how everything did. They started consolidating into those five or six major towns, you know, around the Mobile home, you know, booking office. And that's the way it was until... This is what Skip Wetchen told me. Buddy got itchy feet, and he decided he wanted to move to Phoenix.
Right.
And he wanted to take over
Rod Fenton, right? Rod Fenton.
Yeah, I think it was Rod Fenton or Ernie Muhammad was later, I think. He couldn't get anybody interested in buying that huge ranch. So he talked Lee Fields and his two brothers, Bobby and Don. He said, if you buy the ranch, I'll give you the promotion.
Oh, my
God. You can
gosh.
Have it. Now, this is what Skippy Wetchen told me, so yeah. I'm not sure how true it is. I mean, Buddy Fuller made money. He could trip and fall down and fall into a barrel of money.
Uh-huh.
He was just that lucky. He was a success at everything he ever tried to do. But
do you know much about how he did in Phoenix?
He did okay because he took a lot of the same guys. He took Sputnik. He took Mario Galento. He took a lot of the Gulf Coast guys out there. You know, the guys that had worked for him in Mobile, he took out there.
Because he only stayed out there like 3 years, right?
Yeah, it wasn't
Atlanta,
long.
Came back to Atlanta McIntyre, bought McIntyre's part of the Atlanta deal, right?
Right, exactly. So in 1959, December of 1959, they announced that Lee Fields was buying the promotion. Beginning January 1960, Lee Fields was now the promoter of the Gulf Coast Territory. That only lasted for a year, because by 61, he was back as an active wrestler, and Rocky McGuire was the promoter of record, but Lee owned the territory.
Mm-hmm.
Lee tried to continue running those towns in Mississippi, but Skippy Wetchen had gotten out of it because he wanted to go back to spending more time at the racetrack in Pensacola. So Lee tried to run, I want to say, I can't remember who it was he used over there as the promoter, but he eventually, by 63, they weren't running Mississippi anymore. But in July of 64, now after all this happened and everything, by the end of the 50s, Louisiana, that conglomerate had pretty much died out. You know, none of those people were promoting anymore, with the exception of Jimmy Killshaw's wife, Mrs. Jimmy Killshaw, Claudine Killshaw. She was still promoting. But Gus Callio had health issues, had financial issues. He ended up committing suicide, and the rest of them just aged out. But the whole, that southern part of Louisiana was owned by, the promotional rights was owned by a guy by the name of Harry Romero. I had never heard of him before. I've never seen his name listed anywhere. And the only reason I know that is because Bobby Fields and Bob Kelly told me that that's who Lee bought the promotional rights to Louisiana from, that part of Louisiana from. Because Harry Romero had been running down there, and Adrian Balagione was his booker and his top star. So in July of 64, Lee decided to buy out. He got out of Mississippi totally and bought out Harry Romero. So from 1964 through much of 1965, the Gulf Coast Territory stretched from Tallahassee, Florida, to Lake Charles, Louisiana. That's how big it was.
Huge.
And, you know, but Louisiana was far enough away from the Mobile office, they pretty much set up a total different office down there. It was based in Lafayette. Bill Golden was the promoter on record and the booker. The two boys that used to go along and put out the posters in the towns were a couple of kids named Ricky Gibson and Jimmy Golden.
And for those of you listening who don't know, Bill Golden is a member of the Welch family too.
Yes.
Right.
He's married to Roy Welch's daughter. And the Fields, Don Fields, Bobby Fields, Lee Fields, and their father, their real last name was Hatfield. And they are related to the famous West Virginia Hatfields, the feuding Hatfields of Kentucky, West Virginia. Even though this particular branch of the Hatfields, like the Welchers, were all from Oklahoma. But their father, Virgil Hatfield, Speedy Hatfield, was married to Roy Welch's sister, Bonnie Welch. Mm-hmm. And so that's how they got it. You know, the Welch family, I tried to talk to, back when I was so inclined to try and write a book, I talked to both Roy Lee Welch and Ron Fuller about opening up to me and letting me write the history of the Welch family, because so many people think, oh, the first family of wrestling are the Samoans or the Grahams or what. You know, none of these Hall of Fames, I don't think there's a Welch in any of them.
They're not. It bugs
me. And this family.
It bugs me big time that Roy Welch is not in the Hall of Fame.
This family built the wrestling business in the southeastern part of the United States.
Right.
I mean, at one point, Roy Welch was involved in wrestling in South Carolina, Kentucky, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Northwest Florida, Louisiana.
I was just reading a new book that Scott Teal and Frankie Kane put out.
Yeah.
And Roy Welch was involved in Tampa.
Yes.
In 1951, I believe it said. So
that's when I think, is that when Weingroff was the promoter down there?
He was a promoter down there. Cowboy Luttrell got the office from Roy, I think, in 51. I think it was just so spread out at that point. I mean, Tampa's on down there, you know, in Florida. So and Weingroff was, I believe, in Daytona Beach, maybe the promoter.
Daytona Beach, yeah, he was in Daytona.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, Roy had a lot of lieutenants, you know.
Well, I think I counted the last count I had, and there's been sons of, Jimmy Golden's son has worked, Ron Fuller's son has worked. You know, there were 27 members of that family that were active in the wrestling business. I mean, it even branches from Billy Golden, his brother, Phil Golden,
right,
in opposition, you know, to the Welches out of Paducah, Kentucky.
Yep, that's my hometown.
And the thing about that, all this so-called opposition, Skip Welch clued me in on that. That was Roy Welch's. He was behind manipulating all of that.
He set up
Bill Golden, and we'll talk about Bill Golden later on when we start talking about the results of 75. But Bill Golden was his son-in-law. Bill Golden's brother was a promoter in Paducah, Kentucky. His nephew, Lee Fields, was a promoter in Alabama, in Northwest Florida, Mississippi, you know. So his brother Jack, Lester, you know, and Herb, they were all involved in this stuff. But none of them liked Gulas. They mainly used Gulas as a hatchet man because, you know, Gulas had a small man complex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wanted to act bigger than he was, and he wanted to threaten everybody. I'll blackball you, and I'll make sure you never work anyway. Well, that was all Roy's doing.
Right.
Roy would set Gulas up to tell the boys that, and then he'd come in play good cop, but the whole time he's manipulating all of it.
Yeah, I want to hear more about what you know about Phil Golden and Paducah sometime. Today, but I want to get into that because that's when I first became a wrestling fan, is when Gulas and Welch and Phil Golden were all running in Paducah. They were both running there for about a year.
And who was booking for Phil Golden, don't you? Saul Weingroff.
Sal Weingroff, right? Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, the Von Brauners went over there with Saul.
Yep. Von Brauners were over there. Jerry Barber worked over there.
May Weston was over there with the Bass Boys. She was actually the first female manager I ever saw when I was a kid, and man, she was a heat magnet.
So she came along after Vern Bottoms.
Yeah, she was in Paducah with Ron, and they actually had a guy named Roy Klein, who was Roy Big Mouth Bass. He was another Bass guy that they had in the tag team.
Yeah, and they had she and Donnie Bass were an item back in those days. They were seeing each other.
Yeah, and she had three. She had three of them there, and Donnie wasn't around as much, but he was there. I remember seeing him there.
That worked there was the second Percy Pringle, worked as Percy Pringle there. The first Percy Pringle was a guy that worked for Bruiser in the 60s. There was a Percival and a Chauncey Pringle, mm-hmm. the Pringle brothers. But
yes,
the second Percy Pringle that worked for Phil Golden in Paducah was a Canadian guy by the name of Dennis Baldock, who... when Lee Fields or Bob Kelly fired Ron Bass in 1973 out of the Gulf Coast territory, they were already starting to bring this guy in. They were billing him as Percy Pringle, but then he became Percy Bass, and then he was Bobby Bass, and that's what he spent the rest of his career as. No
right.
class Bobby Bass.
Yeah.
But we're getting off track here.
Anyway,
when Lee moved into Louisiana, kind of pushed Balagion out, was bringing in guys, you know, from he had enough to where he could rotate, you know, guys from the Mobile end to the Louisiana end. Mm-hmm. The biggest stars at that time were the Daltons, Jim and Jack Dalton, which was, of course, Jack Dalton was Don Fargo. And then eventually they came up to the Mobile end. But, yeah, they had it totally separate. It was, you know, they had their own titles, their own programs, their own angles, all that stuff was separate from Mobile. Mobile was, you know, had his thing up here under Rocky McGuire.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you that, because I was wondering when you and I were talking the other day and you said that, I thought, man, I wonder, that's kind of like we had in Tennessee. We had the Western and we had the Eastern end.
Exactly.
And we were on the Western end. We didn't know what was going on in Chattanooga. You know, we didn't see that television and we didn't know any of that, you know, but we knew what was going on in Nashville and Memphis and Evansville and all that. Because that was
right.
On our end. Is that how Gulf Coast was too?
People didn't know
what was going on in
right.
Dothan and Pensacola and that sort of thing.
Not until the 70s. It kind of got closer in there. Now they would list the news. That was another thing that Lee did. Lee was smart enough to hire a guy to be the house ring announcer in Mobile, who also happened to work for the Mobile Press Register by the name of Jack Bitterman. Jack Bitterman used to write half-page articles on the wrestling.
That's great. Giving
blow-by-blow descriptions and the results.
Well, I mean every time I see something like that, I'm thankful for it, because that's the way we have the information today, to have those
exactly.
things like that.
Exactly. But and then he stayed in Louisiana until January 68. He pulled out of Louisiana and opened back up in Mississippi and settled on Hattiesburg, Laurel, Gulfport, Meridian, and for a while, Pascagoula. And while they were in Louisiana, they had a young referee from your neck of the woods, from Louisville, Kentucky, who had broken into the business in Louisville under Wee Willie Davis, the
yeah.
promoter there, doing prelim stuff, but got his big break when he went to North Bay, Ontario, was mainly working as a referee up there, but every once in a while would work under a mask as a wrestler, and was mainly a referee, who got to be big buddies with Ron and Terry Garvin. Well, Ron and Terry Garvin, when they left North Bay, went to Louisiana for Lee Fields, and they told them about this referee. Said the guys, you know, the North Bay was seasonal.
Right, yes.
They didn't run in the wintertime because, you know, all the arenas they ran in were hockey arenas, so they had to get out of them.
Yeah, that's where Dory Funk used to go for summer vacation.
Exactly. They all stayed at Billy Parks' Sunset Inn.
They did.
When he invented the Sunset Flip, that's what he named it after.
Oh, I didn't know that.
His resort up there, yeah.
Yeah, Herb Parks was a superintendent at the Boys Ranch for Cal
yeah.
Farley, and Dory
yeah.
took over for him.
Yep.
And they got to be really good friends, and they'd go up there. As a matter of fact, one of those boys drowned, one of those Parks guys drowned up there. I can't remember if it was which one it was, but it might have been Herb.
It was Herb. It wasn't Dendy. I know that Billy, it wasn't him. But so anyway, they told Lee about this referee, said, you know, the guy needs a place to work. You know, he's a great referee, smart guy, you know, everything. So Lee had him come to Louisiana, or actually had him come to Mobile first. He drove from North Bay, stopped in Louisville, got his family, and then went to Mobile. And that was Cowboy Bob Kelly, what became Cowboy Bob Kelly.
Yeah.
At that time, he was Irish Bob Kelly.
I thought that's where you were going when you said he was from Louisville. I'm like, this has
yep.
got to be Bob Kelly. This has got to be Bob
yep.
Kelly.
So Bob was a referee down there, and then Lee in late 66, Lee and Billy Golden had a parting of the ways, and Bill was gone, and Bob Kelly took over as the booker. They still listed Bill as the promoter down there, but Bob Kelly was actually doing the booking. Les Thatcher said the first time he and the cousins went in down there, Bob Kelly came up to him and said, I used to carry your bag at the you know, the Louisville Gardens, and Lee and Les said, who are you? He said, I'm Bob Kelly. I'm the booker.
Oh, wow.
But, that was a hot territory down there.
Bag carrier to Booker.
And what you mentioned at the beginning of the show, why so many people were not familiar with that territory in Mobile. And Louisiana actually got some magazine write-ups and stuff during some of their stuff down there because of the Daltons, mainly. But Lee would not let anybody in there come in there and write about stuff or do stories on that because, he told Kelly, he said, I'm not trying to sell tickets to people in New York.
Yeah, then that was kind of Roy's mentality too. Roy was kind of a down low guy. He didn't go for a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Outside the territory, he liked to keep it all kind of self-contained, and I understand why.
And Kelly told me just not long before Lee died, Lee said one of his biggest regrets was not letting more writers come in there and do that stuff.
Yeah, because we'd have it now.
Yeah.
And people would have seen how successful it was, if there were more a record of it like that.
Exactly. I mean, because the number of the people who passed through that territory that got their starts there, I mean, it's just unbelievable. I mean, most people don't realize that Gorgeous George, the true Gorgeous George Wagner, was a Gulf Coast champion at one point. Mm-hmm. He only held it a week, but he was there.
Yeah.
Fred Blassie was a regular there. Baron Leone came through there. I mean, that territory had some major, major people there. And the people that started there, Michael Hayes, he was a ring. He used to help me put up the ring, we helped put up the ring. And then he later became a referee, as Mike Seitz. He wrestled a handful of times under his real name, Mike Seitz. Ricky and Robert Gibson, or Reuben, I told Robert, I said, you'll always be Reuben to me because that's all I know you as.
Yeah.
Bill Moody, who became Percy Pringle III, he was sat at ringside, two rows over from me every week.
Wow. That's awesome.
And took pictures and sold them to the magazines, but also sold them to the Mobile Press Register.
Gosh.
I mean, there was just so many guys got their starts there. And again, I'm getting off track. I haven't read Scott's latest book with Frankie. The very first place that Frankie Kane did the Arab gimmick of the Great Mephisto was in Mobile. It was after he took the mask off from being the Mask Mephisto in the first territory after he left Tampa was Mobile. And he was doing the Arab gimmick.
Yeah, it talks about that in the book, and actually his daughter wrote the foreword to the book, and Scott wrote two books with him. The first one is all about his early career, and then the one that
Read the first one, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, the one that came out now is from the Inferno to the Great Mephisto, and in the foreword, his daughter comes home one day from school, and she comes in the house, and Frankie's in there, and he's working on this Great Mephisto character, and she doesn't recognize who he is. Like, she's like, there's some strange man in our house, and she realizes that it's him. But that's how much he really put into that Mephisto gimmick.
But, Frankie Kane, he worked Mobile territory in the 50s and early 60s. But anyway, in 68 is where everything kind of formed was mainly the heyday of the Gulf Coast region. They reestablished the cities in Pensacola. In Mississippi, Bob Kelly was running those. Bob Kelly had Mobile and Pensacola as the booker. And then Rocky McGuire had Panama City, Quincy, Dothan. And that they were separated into three different territories within one territory with three different televisions, three different, sets of programs that they were running, angles they were running, and three different titles. So, That's the way it was.
But they were using the same guys?
The territory was small enough. I mean, there were guys that worked mainly Pensacola and then, Rocky McGuire's end and then the Mobile Pensacola end that didn't work Mississippi. And then they would switch up. The guys that worked that end would go to Mississippi and the others would come over to Mobile. And some guys crossed. Some guys were big enough to cross. Kelly worked Mobile and Mississippi. Of course, those were his towns. But he rarely worked Dothan. I think Kelly worked Dothan twice from 1968 till he quit in 1976. He worked Dothan exactly twice and never worked Panama City. He and Rocky McGuire didn't get along. So,
yeah. I kind of thought that might have been the case.
Yeah. Which that plays into what we're going to talk about, you know, when Barnett became involved. But but that's the way it ran. And their peak year, in my opinion, was 1971. That's when they were running the big auditorium in Mobile, was their main, their largest arena. And they sold it out twice. First time was actually my first live card. My grandfather, who took me to that live card, was his first time going to live wrestling matches in 15 years, 16 years. And the main event was Lee Fields versus Bobby Shane.
Yeah.
Bobby Shane, that was the first territory he ever worked heel. He was working in Georgia as the Boy Wonder, you know.
Yes.
And he called Kelly and said, I want to do something different. I want to be a heel. Can I come in as a heel? And Kelly told him, yeah. And he's, you know, that year he was the most hated person, you know, wrestler in the Mobile territory, and he wrestled there a grand total of 12 times. The rest of the time and he was in Tampa.
Do you think he was that effective as a heel, or was
yes,
it because
absolutely.
Or was it because he was with Lee Fields?
No, he was. Well, the deal with Lee was kind of the culmination of it. But Bobby, when he first came in, of course, he had Sherry with him. Still had mm-hmm. Sherry with him,
yeah.
And he was also had formed a tag team with Terry Garvin, and they had a 16-year-old manager named Jimmy Garvin.
Yes.
And
were they using the pink mat then, or?
No, they only did that in Georgia.
That's what I thought. I wasn't sure.
They only did that in Georgia. But Bobby, what made him effective was he came on television, and, you know, he was the first place he ever wore the crown was in Mobile. He said, I'm the king of wrestling. I will not wrestle on TV. If you want to see me, you're going to have to pay. That number one got him over.
Yeah.
And just, you know, he was used so sporadically because the majority of the time he was in Tampa. You know, they would work an angle around him where, you know, Bobby Shane was booked, but he said, you know, he wasn't making enough money. He wasn't going to come here. And, you know, that would make people hate him that much more. And then the blow off happened with the deal with the culmination with Lee Fields, where he had been, you know, he was always running it. Did you ever see Bobby Shane? Did you ever get to see him live?
Never saw him live. No.
There's so little tape out there of him for people to realize how good he was. He was brilliant.
That's why
he
I wanted
such
to. That's why
a
I,
consummate
that's,
heel.
That's why I wanted to ask you, because not many people have seen him.
But he would, you know, he would do things like he would call Lee Fields, he'd call him Leroy, and stuff like just little nitpicky things like that. And he was always running his mouth about, you know, this and this and this. And finally, Lee told him on television, "No, you are going to do this." And Bobby slapped him,
yeah,
and he fell to the floor. And he got up, and they fought in it. Now, Ricky Fields told me this himself. Ricky Fields was, I think, 12 or 13 years old at the TV studio that day. He had never been smartened up to the business. He ran out there and bit Bobby Shane on the leg.
Oh, my gosh. Well, and was that on live TV, or was that taped?
No, it was taped, but they showed it for weeks because they were
sure.
building up for this big thing for Lee to come out of retirement. And again, this is where, you know, a lot of people didn't care for Kelly as a booker, but as a fan, and after learning about the business and being in the business, I realized how smart Kelly was. You would think for the big, you know, match between Lee and Bobby Shane that Lee would go over. Well, that's not the way they booked it. They booked it that Lee had been, you know, retired for so long that he finally, you know, even though he started out strong, you know, had Bobby bleeding and everything, he weakened and, you know, Bobby beat him. But that allowed them to bring it back three more times.
So, Michael, why didn't people like his booking?
The boys didn't like it. The fans didn't know a difference.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the boys didn't like it because, you know, they all wanted to be on top. But Kelly was never the type of booker that would book himself on top. He was champion a lot of times. He worked more on top in Mississippi because he had fewer guys that he could, you know, could use over there. He had a smaller crew over there. But as far as Mobile and Pensacola, he would book himself on top for a couple of months, and then, you know, he'd pull somebody else in, and he wouldn't even wrestle. He wouldn't even be on the card for months at a time. But then when the talent, the crowd started getting low, he'd book himself back, you know, on there, and they'd build back up. Kelly was a smart booker. I mean, you know, a lot of guys talk about, you know, Leo Garibaldi and Frankie Kane, and they were all brilliant. Tom Ernesto, these guys were all brilliant. But Bob Kelly's name is a name that you never hear because he never worked anywhere but Mobile. But anyway, so that kind of leads us up to where you wanted to go in 1975. So
yeah, so let's just talk about the springtime of 1975 real quick, and we can come back and talk some more about it next time and get into the summertime. But I'm kind of curious, just what's your overall thoughts? Because you were just saying you thought their peak was in 71, so 75, it sounds like they were kind of on the downslide then.
1975 was the beginning, and the end of that year was, or around September of that year, was the two-year suicide started after that. Well, actually, it started in the downhill slide, slow slide, started in 1973 when they moved from the big arena in Mobile to the exposition hall that was adjacent to it. So they went from a 10,000-seat arena to a 3,500 arena, you know, seat, and it was basically a big gym with wooden bleachers.
Yeah.
And the big feel wasn't there anymore. They still had great talent, a lot of the same talent. That's the thing about Mobile. Mobile had a lot of, you know, homegrown talent, guys that were comfortable there. The trips were short. You know, the money was decent enough, and the cost of living was enough where guys wanted to homestead there. Kelly was a good example, but then he was the booker. But guys like Ken Lucas, you know, Rip Tyler and Eddie Sullivan, Frank Dalton, guys like that, Fargo was in and out. So it was a decent enough territory. They had good talent there. They weren't name recognition. I mean, a guy that I don't know if he's in these results here that we're going to go through, but from when he first came in late 73 through the beginning of 77, I would guess, the biggest heel there was Duke Miller, Jerry Miller.
Yes.
Jerry Miller never worked on top anywhere else. The biggest pushes he ever got, and he had been coming to the Mobile territory as a babyface as Jerry Miller from, you know, beginning in the late 50s. But the only places he ever really got pushes were in Louisiana for Leroy McGurk when he first time he worked heel. He and Jim Osborne were the King and the Duke gimmick tag team. He got a decent push in Omaha for Joe Dusick. Isn't that who was the promoter in Omaha? It was Joe, one of the Dusick brothers.
Yes.
I think it was Joe.
That's correct.
But, you know, he had held the Midwest title out there, but, you know, Omaha was like a sub-territory of the AWA. You know, it had its own champions and own angles and all that stuff. But Miller worked on top there. But that was it. But when he came into Mobile, he was such an effective heel. He was probably the most hated heel since Bobby Shane. He was that good. And I kept thinking, you know, I knew who he was because I'd read about him in magazines and other territories. But I'm thinking, why did this guy never work on top anywhere else? He was so good.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that got him over as a heel in Mobile is if you squinted, you'd think he was Mario Galinto. He looked like Mario Galinto. That's how big an impact Galinto still had, you know, 20 years after he'd been in the territory.
What's your overall thoughts about this time period here, these 3 months in 75? Mobile, this is one thing I was curious about. Through the whole history of the territory that we've just been through, was Mobile always Tuesday night's town?
No. Mobile was originally, when Gunther was running it, was a Friday night town. When Fuller came in, he ran Friday nights for a couple of months, and then he moved to Wednesday nights. And it was Wednesday nights until 1973. So from, say, 55 to 1973, it was Wednesday nights. And Kelly told me this, and that he decided to move it to Tuesday nights because they were losing church crowds. And I never saw that. I never bought that because they were huge crowds, you know, especially in the summertime when they were doing, in the 60s, when they were you know, doing Hartwell Field, the ballpark, and everything. They were drawing big crowds. But I don't know what Kelly's deal was there, but he got Bobby Fields angry at him because Tuesday, when they moved to Tucson, that's because Tuesday had been Pascagoula, and that was Bobby Fields' town in Mississippi. And it basically killed Pascagoula. They quit running Pascagoula. And Wednesday became the night off. You know, they didn't run anywhere.
Right.
On Wednesday night.
So let's just go through. Like, so here in 75, Pensacola is a Sunday night town. Panama yeah. City is Monday night.
Panama Mobile's- City bounced back and forth. Sometimes it'd be Monday night. In the summertime, it was usually Thursday nights.
Okay. And then Mobile's Tuesday night. Wednesday is pretty much the night off. Hattiesburg, Mississippi's Thursday. Is there another mm-hmm. Thursday night town besides Mississippi?
Sometimes Panama City. Sometimes okay. Panama City ran on Mondays, and Laurel, I think it was Laurel, Mississippi, was on Monday nights.
Okay.
Meridian was on Friday nights, and Gulfport was on Gulfport was on Saturday nights.
Right, right. And why did they run Gulfport rather than Biloxi? Like you just said, I don't know that.
Biloxi really, until they opened the Mississippi Gulf Coast Coliseum in the mid-70s, there really wasn't anywhere to run there. There was no real building there. And the building they ran in Gulfport doesn't exist anymore, so I never could see it to judge how big it was.
Gotcha.
The place in Hattiesburg was basically, it was an old barn out in the middle of a neighborhood. It was an old auction barn.
The Wade Kennedy Arena was an auction barn, huh?
It was an auction barn, yeah.
Gotcha.
It was just a smaller version of the farm center in Dothan.
Which was on Friday night. Yeah, it was Dothan. What night was Dothan then when Mobile was Friday?
They didn't run. Well, the few times that Gunther ran Dothan, because it really didn't run full-time until Jack Welch took over after the Welches moved in. Gunther ran there whenever he could get a ballpark. It was even on Saturday nights.
The NWA International Heavyweight title is a title that the Funks managed because they were the American bookers for Bob Azzard
right.
Japan. And
right.
Cyclone Negro won that in Amarillo.
Right.
And he, in this period here in 75, he's traveling around with it. He's been to Kansas City. He's been in McGurk's territory. He's been in Amarillo. And he's here in Gulf Coast here in April.
Right.
Do you remember much about Cyclone Negro being there at this time?
He never did television. They showed tapes of him from Amarillo. But
I think it's kind of interesting. He and Jack Briscoe are here the same week.
Yeah.
How did Jack draw here in Gulf Coast?
He drew very well. He drew very well, and he normally only worked Mobile or Dothan because those were the two biggest buildings.
Yeah.
Somehow or another, and I don't know if it was his official week off with the NWA because, you know, he was supposed to get work 3 weeks on, 1 week off, even
right.
though it rarely happened that way. Somehow or another, Rocky McGuire got Jack Briscoe booked into the Rainbow Gardens in Panama City. Now, the Rainbow Gardens, it alternated. It was called the Rainbow Arena, Rainbow Gardens. You know, gave it a fancy-sounding name. Basically, it was a skating rink. In fact, the building is still there. It is now a U-Haul Center.
Oh,
so
man.
So it tells you how small it is.
Yeah.
But Briscoe defended the world title in there against Duke Miller. I'm sure he was pissed about
it. Not sure what.
But he drew very well, and they always had him. The majority he wrestled Ken Lucas a couple times, which were great matches. But his main opponent was Leon Baxter, Tarzan Baxter, the wrestling pro.
Yes,
and they had some great matches, and they were familiar with each other because when Jack was breaking in with McGurk. In the mid-60s, Baxter was a mainstay out there. It was Tarzan Baxter. He was the U.S. junior heavyweight title holder all the time out there then.
Yeah, the other thing that sticks out here just to me is the Alabama title. And is that a title they used much? Because you didn't mention it earlier. So is that just kind of a...
Yeah, that title was created in 1963 because Dothan, the Gulf Coast title was the main singles title, and it was mainly defended in Mobile and sometimes in Pensacola. But Dothan rarely got, every once in a while they'd get a title match over there, but they wanted to create something, mainly they were created it for Don Fields, because he was kind of the forgotten Fields brother. He was the middle brother, so, you know, Bobby was the young, flashy, you know, high flyer. Lee was the old all-time favorite, and Don was just kind of Don, kind of there in the middle. Now, he and Bobby were perennial Southern Tag Team Champions and Nashville World Tag Team Champions, but they created the Alabama title to have Don have a title because they wanted him to work some single stuff. Well, a week after he won it, he was in a terrible automobile crash, and it ended his career.
Oh, wow.
So the title kind of went dormant. They revived it in 1970, and they had a tournament, kind of thing. Ken Lucas won it. He beat Dick Steinborn in the finale and won the Alabama title. But that title, because Kelly either held the Gulf Coast title or it was defended in his towns, Mobile and Pensacola, mainly Mobile, he didn't let it get defended in Rocky's towns. So Rocky wanted the Alabama title back over there. And it stayed over. It was Dothan. I mentioned each of the three, Mississippi, Dothan, and Mobile, had their own titles and their own angles and all that stuff. Well, the Alabama title was Rocky's title. And either the pro or Ken Lucas, or mainly Dick Dunn. I think Dick Dunn held that title 38 times.
Mm-hmm. And did they have city titles too? Or just
they did have city titles. They had the Panama City title. And it's funny, I just said about Baxter having the U.S. Junior Heavyweight title, and for McGurk, that was the belt they used for the Panama City title. Still had U.S. Junior Heavyweight title on it.
Yeah.
You know, nobody ever looked at it, so, you know.
No, fans didn't. They just saw a belt, shiny belt.
Yeah, Mobile and Pensacola both had city titles. I think Kelly did that because Rocky had the Panama City title. They both had trophies. And then Kelly had tag team titles for each city in Mississippi, but they were jackets, satin jackets, with the name of the city on the back of it.
Yeah, I think Bobby mentioned that to me the other day, that you had told him about that they had jackets. That's cool.
Yeah.
So in May, there's an interesting character here that was working with Dick Beyer in the AWA, and then he comes down here in the Gulf Coast after that kind of run. He took some time off and then came down here as Dr. X. Was that Red Osborne? That's Dr. X?
Jim Osborne, Red
Jim
Osborne, yeah.
Yeah.
He was double X for Vern in Minnesota with Beyer, but then he was from Oklahoma, I think, originally. He was worked for McGurk. He started off as Red Osborne. That was before he was double X. But after the double X gimmick, he went into Oklahoma, Louisiana as Dr. X, the built-up shoe, you know, like the Infernos. He was McGurk's World Junior Heavyweight Champion for, I think, a year.
Yeah.
So, he was...
He goes over there and does that at the end of this run here, after Gulf Coast, I think.
No, he was that before. He was Junior Heavyweight Champion in 71.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. That's right. You're right about that.
So I wasn't even sure that it was actually him until I saw him live. Then I knew it was Osborne.
Mm-hmm. And so when did they, and so when, you might have said this, the Gulf Coast title was the Mobile title, the one they used in Mobile then, right?
Yeah, it was the main title. I mean, it was defended in Mississippi every once in a while, but it was the main title in Mobile, and then Mobile had the Mobile City Championship. And then by 75, they had done away with the U.S. tag team titles, and their main tag title was the Gulf Coast tag team titles.
I mean,
and those titles were defended everywhere.
I mean, on the 16th in Dothan, J.C. Dykes, who did work in matches, but he was a manager, goes over on Dick Dunn, who's like a local legend. Like,
and won the Alabama title.
Yeah, isn't that strange?
But he was... had so much heat over there because they were working an angle with him, kind of like the Bobby Shane, Lee Fields thing. They were working a deal with he and Rocky McGuire. And it's odd that you mentioned that. I had a, back when I still had my clippings, I had a clipping from Louisiana in 1957 or 58 of a Jimmy Dykes wrestling there. That was before he was refereeing. I guess he wanted to wrestle, and he asked Roy Welsh to let him go somewhere. So he went down to Louisiana and worked one match, and next thing you know, he's back in Tennessee as a referee. That was before the formation of the Infernos and that stuff. But
well, we're running kind of out of time. I'm going to look real quick here. I just wanted to hit the highlights of some of these things. Look here in June and see. Is there anything in June that you see that's kind of interesting or that sticks out to you in June of 75?
Yeah, I noticed the thing as I was going through here, they have Mighty Yankee number 2 listed and then a Mighty Yankee number 3 listed. Well, there was a Mighty Yankee number 2, but not at this point. The Mighty Yankee that they have listed in these for April, May, and June were all Mighty Yankee number 3. And that was an odd deal as well. Duke Miller, who I'd mentioned earlier, was the longtime Gulf Coast champion. I mean, he was Gulf Coast champion for months and months and months at a time. But somehow or another, he had been suspended. So they worked a deal where they were having a tournament to reinstate the Gulf Coast tag team titles. And one of the teams in there was the Mighty Yankees. Now, Curtis Smith, who was the Mighty Yankee number 1, Curtis Smith was the ultimate mask guy in the Gulf Coast. He started out there in 69 as the Blue Yankee, came back in 72 as the Spoiler, came back in 74 and 75 as the Mighty Yankee, came back in 76 as the Challenger, came back in 77, right back where he started. He was the Blue Yankee.
Wow.
But anyway, they put Miller under a mask, teamed him with Curtis Smith. They were the Mighty Yankees. Miller was the Mighty Yankee number 2. This was in, I want to say, February, March, somewhere along that line. Well, they had a falling out, and they split. Miller, because he was under suspension, couldn't take the mask off, so he changed his name to the ex-Yankee and started teaming with the Wrestling Pro, and they had a feud with Mighty Yankees number 1 and number 3 over the Gulf Coast title. Each one of them had a run with the title. Each team had a run with the title. So, and the Mighty Yankee number 3 was a guy from Indianapolis named Mike McManus. He had been in the territory earlier in the year as Bruiser McManus for a week or two, and he teamed with a guy that was, I want to say, had worked in Paducah. I can't think of what his name was. God, I can't think of what his name is now. But anyway, McManus was stayed with Curtis and J.C. Dykes for another 3 or 4 years, because after the Yankee gimmick, they did it in Mobile, and they went to Georgia as the Yankees. And then they came back. They were in Mobile in 76 as the Challengers, and they were the final version of J.C. Dykes' Infernos out in Los Angeles.
Huh, okay.
But that's how that is. And Miller was gone by this time. I think he'd gone to Tennessee or somewhere. He was killed in Tampa. I think he was in Tampa when he was killed, but that wasn't until 77.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, Michael, this has been fantastic. I loved all the history. I thank you for taking me through all that. I learned a lot.
I'm sorry we didn't get to going through these, because there are some things that we can talk about in here. But if you want to do this again, just let me know, and we'll keep all this information, and we'll definitely spend more time on these. So
yeah, you hang on to it, because I want to come back to this and talk some more about some of this, these results in 75 and some more results in 75. So you just hang on to them. We'll come back to them in next time we get together, which will be in a couple of weeks, and we'll go back and talk about this. And by then I'll have digested everything you told me and educated me on, and I'll probably have questions for you. So it'll be a good time. I appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all this with us, because I'm dedicated to preserving all of this and keeping it for this generation for sure, and any future generations, because this is really, to me, it's really important stuff. And I think to any newer wrestling fan or modern wrestling fan who really wants to know the history, there's just not that many places around because everybody's focused on the current stuff. And I understand that, and that's okay. I want to be focused on this, though. This is my jam right here. So thank you so much for sharing this. I appreciate it.
Not a problem.
Michael Norris, and he's going to be back with us, and we're going to talk more Gulf Coast coming up in the weeks ahead. Appreciate you joining us tonight. This is Territories, Towns, and Buildings. We're here on the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast, and we'll see you again next time. Well, I hope you enjoyed sitting in on our visit today, taking a trip back in the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. Hey, visit my Substack channel, at TonyRichards4. Subscribing to my newsletter helps support the work I do to preserve pro wrestling history. Plus, you get it in your email inbox every single morning, and you never miss an issue of the newsletter or a podcast if you have a free subscription. If you have a paid subscription, that supports my work even more, and you'll get special stuff in the vault. Updates on my Dory Funk Sr. book, which is coming along really, really nicely. I'm close to the end of the research phase and about to start the writing phase later on this fall. I appreciate your investment of time in our show today, and I hope you like and subscribe our podcast and our newsletter. And until next time, bye-bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel podcast. Tune in for another great episode next week, interviewing wrestlers, referees, and media personalities that have made the sport of professional wrestling great. Be sure to follow us on Facebook at Pro Wrestling Time Tunnel. We'll release a new episode soon. Don't you dare miss it.